I want to welcome you, Dr. Khan, to HMI Radio, and thank you for coming on to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Just because time is limited, I'm just going to dive right into the question in here.
Please do.
Okay. Well, I know the audience may not be familiar with you. You are independent U.S. presidential candidate right now.
Yes.
And I know that. Now, are you on the ballot as of thus?
Well, getting right into how hard it is for independent candidates to get on the ballot, either on the ballot where someone could push a button or flip a lever, versus qualifying to be on the ballot as a write-in candidate.
Okay,
the rules are different. Excuse me. The rules are different in every single state.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. I bet. I remember years ago when Ross Perot was running. And, you know, I guess he had enough money to do, you know, what he did, which was basically break the doors open to be an independent. But for those that may not be rolling in the dough, so to speak, not to insinuate that you may not be, however,
I'm not.
usually, you know, unless you have millions and trillions of dollars or behind the door connects to get in, I can understand that it would be really, really hard.
It's hard. For me personally, so most of last year, 2015, I announced in the end of March, 2015, it was really about why am I doing this? What is my message? Which always was fix government and build peace. That's my platform, fix government and build peace.
Yes.
But a lot of last year for me was, can I stand on a stage? Can I tell my stories? Can I talk about my platform? Can I talk about how I would go into each federal department and make significant changes? Can I talk about peace building? Can I answer questions?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to answer them in 90 seconds. You know, so last year was about that. And then all of a sudden this year, it was totally, oh, all right, now exactly how do we get on the ballot? And it was, some of it we had done towards the end of last year. But if the rules are different in every state. So in Maryland, Maryland. There was a lawsuit. It used to be I would have had to collect 25,000 signatures.
Right, okay.
And there was a lawsuit, so now maybe it's 10,000 signatures.
Wow.
When I went, and for as comparison, in Ohio, it's 5,000 signatures.
Wow.
In Florida, it's like 120,000 signatures. Mm-hmm. It's really different. There's no rationale. There's no logic. In Maryland, when I tried to submit my paperwork to say I wanted to be a candidate last March,
okay,
2016, they turned me down because they said that I didn't meet the deadline as defined on the website. But I appealed that decision saying, but the deadline on the website is totally different than the deadline in the Maryland election law.
Uh-huh.
And let me cite some court precedent that says, if there's a difference, you can't pick the earlier date. You have to pick the later date. Some of which actually is because of Ross Perot filed a lot of lawsuits. So did John Anderson and Ralph Nader. So I appealed that and they said, okay, the attorney general ruled in my favor. But by then it was 3 months later.
Wow.
And then to collect the signatures. So it's so bizarre and so different in every single state.
I'm sure that would have my head spinning all day, every day, if I had to go through that. So thank you for going through that, because I actually, now let me say for the record, because I study under the Moorish Temple, I really don't get into the whole voting thing. I really don't. But I feel like my spiritual role here is to bridge the gap for those that do get into politics and government, to help the public know that there is more than two brands that are selling right now, which is Democrat and Republican. So, you know, I want to bring a different point of view to them through you as an independent that's running. So they can have a better, well-rounded idea of what is out there for them to select. Like, I could never understand why do people always tend to think it's only two parties that's running. You know, I knew this back in my teenage years that you have more than two brands, you know.
Well, good for you. And first, let me thank you for doing this. I mean, it takes kind of an outgoing wanting to understand what's really happening in the world, mm-hmm. which you're doing. Thank you. And it takes some courage to talk about independent candidates, because I think that given that more people identify themselves as independents than Republican or Democrat, I think the two parties are nervous about what the independents are doing. And this has been a phenomenal 2 years, and it's because of social media. So independent candidates are finding each other. We're finding independent parties. We're finding independent activists. So a huge amount is going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's only responsible for someone that may go out and vote to understand or at least get an idea of all political views that are on the table before pushing a button. You know, it's just irresponsible to me to go out and take a poll and, you know, say, hey, this is what I elect for my children in the future. No. Like, slow down. Let's really look at this thing here, you know? Well, now, I've had the privilege to read, and I won't say all, but some of the interview that you did with the independentpoliticalreport.com. So I'm a little bit familiar with your background. But for those that do not know, who is Dr. Lynn S. Kahn? Who is she? Is she another Kahn? You know, I want you to introduce yourself thoroughly, giving us a little bit about your background and your history.
Absolutely. I'm Dr. Lynn Sandra Kahn. My PhD is in clinical psychology, so I started out as a therapist with expertise in group dynamics. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, I became interested in organizational dynamics and organizational conflict. I worked 32 years as an organizational psychologist inside the federal government, 22 years with the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. And for 6.5 years, I represented the FAA on the White House Partnership to Reinvent Government. So I really understand how our federal departments and agencies operate. I've been called the government mechanic. No, it's not. I think I'm a little more visionary than that, but look under the hood. I can see what's working, what's not working, what needs to be changed, what needs to be junked. And I'm not the only one that knows how to do it. There are a lot of people that understand how government, federal departments and agencies operate. Mm-hmm. But I come at it from the point of view of there's an enormous need across America for government agencies that actually deliver results.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pain out there. I've driven over 40,000 miles around the country. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pain, a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. And what really irks me is that there's hundreds of billions of dollars of waste sloshing around in our bureaucracies.
Yeah.
And I know everybody talks about cutting waste. I actually know how to do it. I know how to go into departments like the U.S. Department of Education, which I believe has failed this nation for decades.
Yeah.
We ranked 17 in the world just with respect to teaching reading. I mean, we can't even teach reading, let alone all the other problems that we have in our schools, which I attribute to the overreach of the Federal Department of Education. Well, they have a $70 billion budget. About $30 billion has to go out to the states already. What do they do with that other $40 billion? I don't know. There's no results. You got a million kids dropping out of high school every year. You have suspensions and expulsions from school that are worse for students of color and students with special needs than anybody else. there are serious, there's sexual harassment, there's bullying, there are serious problems in our school systems. Mm-hmm. I want that $30 billion of waste, that $30 billion that doesn't go to anything that delivers results. I want to look at ways to send it back to the schools mm-hmm. in our country, back to the states and the schools, so that we can close the education funding gap, among other accomplishments I think could happen. So that's the point of view of someone who can go in, can issue a hard freeze, no more hiring, no more training, no more travel, no promotions, stop what you're doing, mm-hmm. and then say, let's evaluate every single program and see what the results are. And there's lists of programs with no results.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just education. The same thing is true in justice and veterans affairs and housing. Housing and urban development, not only one of the most corrupt federal departments, mm-hmm. built on an absolutely broken model. That model for public housing is broken. It doesn't work.
It's a lot that's broken.
Yes.
Actually, my mom, she worked in government for over 35 years. So I was pretty much privy to hearing all the issues that went on inside of her department in particular. Now, I know you talk a lot about fixing government and building peace on your platform. Could you expand on that just a little bit? I know you touched on some of it, but.
Sure.
Yeah.
So my platform is Fix Government and Build Peace. I've written 3 books, 2 books about government reform, and my first book published in 1988, maybe before you were born.
No, I was born in 72, so I was still a little one.
My first book was called Peacemaking. So for me, conflict resolution and building peace are deeply connected to fixing our broken government. You can't separate the anger and frustration of people around this country from our failed government. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about building peace, there's 2 parts. One is here at home and the other is for me with the U.S. Department of Justice. It's like you track every single problem back to the federal department in the president's cabinet that should be leading the charge to solve that problem and isn't. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. Department of Justice, right now, their mission statement is organized around 3 words, control, enforcement, and punishment. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's your purpose in life, you're never going to solve the problems that we have with mass incarceration, with racism, with police violence. School to prison pipelines, it's not going in that direction. And because everything's connected, if the mission is broken, then the priorities and the budgets and the programs and the staffing and the measurements, they're all broken too. Mm-hmm. So for me, building peace here at home starts with going in and changing the purpose of the U.S. Department of Justice. So it focuses on a transition to genuine community policing, not community policing in name, but true community policing with community engagement. And supporting all the other kinds of activities that need to take place if we're going to transition to community policing. I believe we need to have dialogue between police departments and the communities they serve everywhere. Mm-hmm. I called October 1st for a ceasefire, U.S. ceasefire and peace talks all across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because the tension between police departments and communities is really near the breaking point in way too many.
Yeah, definitely. I guess that's my overall concern. Like, how do we actually fix individuals that have been spiritually broken, psychologically maimed in a sense, that happen to be in a position of power and control? How do we even get close enough to heal, if we can heal them or remove them from government in a sense, in order to start fixing and rebuilding? That is a tough job.
Well, good for you for asking the toughest question. A president, even a governor, even a mayor can't do it everywhere. You have to set in place the incentives and the barriers for the 17,000 law enforcement agencies in this country to do business differently. So some of it is saying, here's a new standard. Here's the training that we want. Here's the numbers. Finally, the U.S. Department of Justice is collecting numbers on people killed and hurt by law enforcement, and the other way too. So we have to set in place some standards that say moving towards community policing. And then you go deep, you follow the money. At the federal level, you follow the money. You go deep into how does the Department of Justice spend our taxpayer money? Mm-hmm. And you just put different requirements in the contracting systems. Mm-hmm. So no more buying SWAT weapons and no more support for militarizing our police force. The only dollars are going to go towards departments which are moving towards community policing, which are engaging citizens in dialogue, and which understand they need to look internally. They need to have the courage to take on those folks in uniform that shouldn't have a gun and should be in the position of power for the reasons that you mm-hmm.
Now, I wonder, how do you ensure that money is actually go to where it's supposed to go? My idea is that the money that is actually missing in government that you really can't trace is the money that's used as a tax write-off, and it's in the pocket of the politicians that occupy power at this point. So how do we ensure that the money goes into the right departments or the right place to make sure that funding is available for programs that are supposedly going to work?
Well, I'll only fund the programs that do work. And I've been driving around the country, and I'm actually finding a lot of programs that do work. I think politicians that make money off of their position and their power don't do it by taking money directly. They get it from lobbyists who want them to vote a certain way, like vote for for-profit prisons, for example, mm-hmm. are horribly destructive and have no redeeming value, and we shouldn't be funding any of them. I worked in aviation for 22 years, and I understand really clear contracting systems or acquisition systems mm-hmm. because we don't have planes falling out of the sky in general in America. So there's something that's right about the way aviation, that includes the government and the airlines and the manufacturers and the airports and the training and everything else that goes along with helping a plane fly safely. Mm-hmm. It all has to come together in their acquisition system. So I learned how you make sure, just what you said, you make sure that the money goes to the programs that have been identified. You have a very clear process. Mm-hmm. It's very disciplined in aviation. You don't get money if you can't prove that it's going where you say it should be going. Mm-hmm. Imagine my surprise when I started looking at other government departments. Not only are they not disciplined in how they spend money, there's no process. Mm-hmm. There's a department event. When you buy, I like this, when you buy a new toothbrush, you do more analysis, $1 million.
Sorry about that. You broke up. When you buy, I didn't get that.
When you buy a toothbrush, mm-hmm. you do more analysis than the U.S. Department of Energy does when they spend, write a check for $5 billion.
Yeah.
At least when you buy a toothbrush, you look at your alternatives. Do I want the old-fashioned manual kind? Do I want a new hard bristles, soft bristles? It's called alternatives analysis. The U.S. Department of Energy doesn't do it, and they've been dinged over and over again by audit agencies who say you have to have a process for spending money, and they don't.
Right.
And there's one example of a Department of Energy program that went from $4 billion to $11 billion to $28. Now it's $41 billion. And
wow.
Somebody else came along and said, you know, you could do it for $17 billion if you looked at your alternatives. But so it's broken. It's broken
in
many ways.
Well, with that being said, Is there any issue or any particular area of government that you would tackle first? And if so, why would you start there?
Okay. But let me say that I didn't finish about building peace around the world. So we.
Oh, sorry.
You know, people ask me that. And when you understand, I understand that the mission statement, Mike, am I still on?
Yeah, you are. It was just the connection is very weird. So, but you're fine now. I can hear you.
The mission statement, the overriding purpose of most of our federal departments is really bizarre. Mm-hmm. It's out of touch. Like I said about the Justice Department, you could go through all of them. And what I've been doing videos, and what I've said is, here's my day one in the White House. Mm-hmm. I'm a morning person. I want my national security briefing at 7:30 in the morning. 9 o'clock, because I've made this promise, I'm going to start with Veterans Affairs. We're going to go into the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. We're going to change the mission statement so it says world-class medical services and benefits. Mm. Do you know there's 100 medical facilities of the Veterans Administration that are under criminal investigation?
Wow.
That's 100 VA medical facilities under criminal investigation.
Wow.
So step one, the mission, step VA facilities, teams that'll pretty much take charge. And I want 2 veterans. I want a financial auditor because the books are cooked. I want a medical specialist because sometimes they don't know what they're doing. A management consultant like an organizational psychologist. I'm not easy. And demand and require that those facilities move towards a model of world-class services and benefits. Mm-hmm. And the third thing for veterans is to expand something called the Veterans Choice Program so they can go wherever they want for medical and mental health services. Mm. So we're, you know, I can do that in an hour.
Okay.
You know, okay. It's not like I'm going to do all the work. It's not like I'm one of those 100 teams that we're sending out. But I understand what to do. So I promised veterans groups I'd start with my first executive order would be about veterans. The second one, 9 o'clock VA, 10 o'clock justice. Kick that department onto the path of community policing. It's mm-hmm. the same. Change the mission, go deep into the, follow the money, go into the contracting systems of justice, put in new requirements, take out the requirements that are building up a militarized police force. And then in justice, go into that very long list of broken policies mm-hmm. that we hear about all the time. I mean, eliminate solitary confinement, have civilian oversight boards. I mean, it just goes on and on. So in justice, it's the mission, it's follow the money, and then it's fix the broken policies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's something that can be kicked off and started on day one. That's not 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. At 11 a.m. Next up, the U.S. Department of Education.
Now, let me ask, how much coffee would you need in between that time?
I drink a couple in the morning, but I actually don't drink after. I'm pretty wired anyway.
Okay.
I'm pretty high energy.
All right. So does this also describe your vision for the 21st century economy? Was that just a part of it?
Well, it's a big, or maybe lots of things are part of the 21st century economy. Thank you for asking. The way I think about a 21st century economy is that everyone who wants a job ought to be able to find a good paying job with benefits. And America must be competitive in the world economy. So that's kind of the big picture. When I think there's the kind of high level, what are all the strategic pieces that have to fit together? And then there's the on the ground reality. I don't believe the government numbers that say unemployment is 5% and poverty is 14%. I think mm-hmm. unemployment is at least 11%. There are communities where it's 20, 30, and 40% mm-hmm. and more. Mm-hmm. And I believe that poverty is 34%, which means one out of every three Americans struggles every single day with hunger and homelessness and economic insecurity and fears that something's going to go wrong and they can't pay for it. So we have to start by measuring the truth, telling the truth. So then I think, well, what are those big pieces? Mm-hmm. And the big pieces are like a 21st century infrastructure, which could absorb many, many millions of jobs. And by infrastructure, I mean all of it: highways, roadways, waterways, tunnels, bridges, ports, the internet, water systems, pipe systems, all of that physical stuff needs upgrading, and it needs to be done on a 21st century design. Same with housing and the same with transportation. So those are the big chunks, and the foundation would be a 21st century education system. So those are the big pieces, but that doesn't help the 100 million Americans that are struggling with poverty every day. So I think we have to figure out what are the entry-level, respectful entry-level jobs that we can identify. For example, I'd like to increase the slots in Job Corps and AmeriCorps by 200,000 for 200,000 more folks. Mm-hmm. These are great programs that have successfully helped people kind of transition from maybe having dropped out of high school or just barely finished into mm-hmm. understanding what the world of work requires. Mm-hmm. The same thing is true about, I want to hire 100,000 vets to help vets with post-traumatic stress. I want to hire, if we talk about this transition towards community policing, I could talk about that for a long time.
Yeah,
I did probation reform work in New York City, and we found with the right set of neighborhood-based services, people turned their lives around. And instead of 66% going back to jail or prison, the success rate is like 88%. That means only 10 or 12% are going back to prison. I talked on my website as a description of a program for young people on probation. It was an 89% success rate. That was like investing $400 million into this community. Mm-hmm. So there are great programs out there. The federal government gets in the way. There are lots of kinds of jobs. So if we do justice reform the way I envision it, it could absorb 100,000, 200,000 people as coaches and mentors for those who are diverted from jail or prison or coming out of jail or prison. Mm-hmm. Need services. Mm-hmm. You know, they folks that end up in trouble with the criminal justice system often haven't taken advantage of, just don't have access to the right kind of services. That's true for people who come out, get into trouble, and go right back in. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of jobs, including preschool, you know, expanding preschool. That's a whole other set of jobs mm-hmm. that where people could be hired right away that don't have to have really.
How do you grab jobs back? Because a lot of jobs currently have been outsourced. How do you grab them back? You know, that's a long process. I don't think it could be mapped out within 4 years.
I don't know. Some of it can be done. I saw changes when we did probation reform in 18 months.
Okay.
So you don't, whatever the contracting mechanism is in place, that's what you use, but they hired tons of coaches and mentors from neighborhoods to do this work. Mm-hmm. It may not have been hired by that agency. They might have had a contract with a community organization. It's on the ground. Federal government operates at such a high level, they forget that you have to, you know, location matters. Location, location, location. What might need to be done here in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. might be totally different than I was just in Texarkana. You know, it's totally mm-hmm. different there. So mm-hmm. what does that community need? It has to be focused on the location, not some big high-level program that doesn't deliver results.
Mm-hmm. So you talked a little bit about your vision for the 21st century. Infrastructure, you did mention building infrastructure there. How do you feel about the Dakota Pipeline issue?
Oh, my goodness.
How do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, I'm against the pipeline itself. Second mm-hmm. of all, I think I actually have been tweeting, where's justice? I mean, it's an enormous miscarriage of justice how those protesters are being treated.
Yeah.
It's unconstitutional how they're being treated.
The project alone
is a horrible idea.
Okay.
Right? Carting oil over, under and around water systems that people rely on for drinking water, mm-hmm. Terrible idea. And bless those brave souls that are protesting. And I don't understand why what North Dakota has been doing isn't illegal and unconstitutional. I want to know, where is the Justice Department, not just for stopping the pipeline, which they did temporarily, but in going after the people that have been mistreating protesters and journalists.
Yeah. And from my understanding, there are still some protesters that are behind bars till this day. Amy Goodman, she happened to breeze through it, but I applaud her for speaking out about protesters that are still behind bars.
Yep.
So, I mean, I believe we are now living in a nation that has become more and more divided. Like, we're constantly bombarded with images of violence, sexual exploitation, betrayal. And currently, although it's been going on throughout history for the longest period of time, it's being highlighted now, the amount of police brutality that's going on in our streets. So, I mean, these images to me are sort of being etched and woven into our subconscious to either promote us to live in fear or to become hostile in the environment in order to survive. Now, if you were elected, how would you handle the growing tension? Because it's already at its peak. How would you handle the growing tension of racism along with police brutality?
I think police violence is easier than racism in some ways.
Okay.
You just have to, you know, you're a child. My son went to a school that was 25% white. I mean, I think our young folks have a different way of being in the world, and diversity is second nature. That's what they expect. And I think some of the older folks, they're just not going to change. You know, they don't like you because of what you look like. They don't look like me because of what I look like, you know.
Or maybe not what you look like, but what you think like.
Yeah, you know, I always go one, as a change agent, right? Organizational psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
I always go one third, one third, and one third. Mm-hmm. You go into a new system, like when that new commissioner went into probation. One third of the people, the day he started talking, they were right there with him. They've been waiting for him. Another third, they're on the fence. They're going to wait and see which way the wind blows. You know, the politician's going to line up and support him. Is he going to leave in 12 months, which most of them do? By the way, he stayed for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a third, you can't change them. They can't change. And you just like sideline them, help them find a different job, tell them they're, you know, I mean, you have to be brutally honest.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you know, they just aren't going to change. I think that's true with racism.
Yeah.
I just want to add one thing, which is...
And you got pretty dark there.
You know, I thought about... Oh.
Your background light or something has gone away.
I'll just turn a light on.
There we go. We now have sunshine. Okay.
So I've done conflict resolution and peace building stuff for decades. My first book was Peacemaking. I looked at the rise and fall of hostility and support in face-to-face groups. So I've been looking at anger and peacemaking for decades. Am I still on?
Yeah, you're here. You're here.
I've done team building. I've done conflict resolution. I've done labor management stuff. I designed a citywide summit on violence for Cleveland about 20 years ago. I've done probation reform, juvenile services reform, homeless services reform. So I have a lot of colleagues that are in international peacemaking, international conflict resolution. So I've been thinking about this stuff for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I forgot which incident today on my first day in office? What would I want to say in my inaugural address? And that was when I said to myself, I would declare a U.S. ceasefire. I mean, we just have to stop. And so I did. On October 1st, I issued a, not taken very well, but you know, that's, you know, what's my vision? What would I do? I would say, stop. Okay. And I gave a very simple design about how you actually have dialogue. I said, it has to start in law enforcement. It also has to go on in schools. Mm-hmm. Our schools at every level are way too hostile and violent and aggressive, and there's too much assaults all over the place. Mm-hmm. So it has to go on. It's that dialogue. What can we do to reduce violence in our school? What's one action? Mm-hmm. So you have to have the conversation in law enforcement. You have to have a conversation in education systems at all levels. And I finished by saying, we have to have that conversation in every single federal government department and agency, because we, the people, are pissed off. No, we've just had it with the failures of our government departments and agencies. So I, that's what I would do. I would talk about, what are we going to do today to reduce and prevent violence? What's the one action locally that each of these groups meeting and dialogue can take to reduce and prevent violence? Mm-hmm. So it's a big theme for me, and it's deeply connected to fixing government.
I agree. It's that's a lot to take on. Like I stated before, it's a lot to take on. I in my vision, I don't see it happening in 4 years, but who's to say? Who's to say? It may, it may not.
But, depends on who's leading those 4 years.
Exactly, exactly. Well, while we're talking about all the hostility and racism and police brutality in the world, how do you feel, or let me ask this way, dealing with foreign relations, what's your standard with dealing with foreign policy issues?
So now you're going to see how an organizational psychologist thinks. You know, I'm an organizational psychologist. You give me a problem, I get people together. What's the roadmap? How are we going forward? Who are the partners? How do you check in and make sure it's going on the right way? What's the measures of success? How do you coordinate? So that's how I think. Mm-hmm. So I have a new doctrine, a 5-point doctrine for war and peace building in the 21st century. And if I can, I'll do it briefly. And then if you want to ask questions.
Okay.
So 5 points. Number one, we have to be strong to build peace. Mm-hmm. We can't build peace from a position of weakness. So I do want a strong military. I also want us to be stronger at home, which goes back to fixing our broken government. Point number two is clarity of roles. I believe the purpose of the Department of Defense is to protect our homeland, and the purpose of the State Department is to build peace. Mm-hmm. That's it. I don't want to see the State Department negotiating arms deals. I want the State Department to be on top of every conflict zone around the world and know who are the peace builders that are working to create a ceasefire or bring together peace talks or follow up on peace talks that might have fallen apart. Mm-hmm. That's what our State Department ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. The third point is rule number three, building peace doesn't mean being stupid. Mm-hmm. I get it. You can't sweet, you know, what I teach my son in kindergarten, can't sweet talk a bully, and you can't negotiate with psychopaths and sociopaths. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people running around with really big guns that have crossed a very dark line, and they're not part of my peace talks because they don't know how to have relationships with people.
So what do you do with them?
All right, let me do 4 and 5. All right, so 4, wiser foreign policy decisions. I think we've made very stupid foreign policy decisions actually for decades. I think that big business and the arms dealers and defense companies have captured the decision-making process of the State Department and the White House. And that's why I think I'm the perfect person to be the next president, because I am talking about peace building. Mm-hmm. So we've made horrible foreign policy decisions because we haven't listened to our diplomats, our intelligence experts, and we haven't demanded accountability and integrity from our international partners. And we're seeing that, as Saudi Arabia recently said, oh, yes, it's true. We have been sending money to schools that teach terrorism. And the fifth part is we have to tilt Washington, D.C. towards peace building. The tensions that you talked about, the gridlock, we're not going to survive if that keeps going. Mm-hmm. I think some of it might change with this election, hard to say right now. I do believe only an independent president can negotiate among Republicans and Democrats to get stuff done, because there are little clusters of them that want to do things in different areas. But a Republican won't help a Democrat, and a Democrat won't help a Republican. So vote independent.
All right, quickly, because we're winding down on time here, I'm going to ask your position on a few topics, and you can answer in any order that you feel comfortable with. I wanted to know your position on healthcare, immigration, women's rights, and youth voting rights.
Yes for women's rights, yes for youth voting rights. Immigration will take more than a sound bite, but I'll talk to that. And what was the first one? Oh, no, I forgot. I didn't write it down.
Healthcare.
So I think we reinvented health insurance and not healthcare. And I don't think it's working very well. I've driven 40,000 miles around the country. There are parts of the country you go and you see these billboards and they're electronic. How many minutes do you have to wait for emergency room visits? 6 minutes, 4 minutes, 8 minutes. I brought someone to a friend to a emergency room in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, and it would have been a 4.5 hour wait. And he was in excruciating pain from an imploding tooth problem. Mm-hmm. 4.5 hours wait. That's not good health care. No. And as I drive around the country, everybody is anxious about health care. So what I believe is that you have to just kind of outflank the insurance companies and put money into public health systems, mm-hmm. public clinics, public health systems. Put 100,000 nurses back in schools. Mm-hmm. Provide incentives for employers to create partnerships with local health clinics. I mean, I just don't see it working. All the insurance companies have us in a not very happy position.
Mm-hmm. Feel about bridging the gap between conventional modern medicine and holistic healing?
Absolutely have to go. You also have to go towards prevention. Mm-hmm. That's not part of how we teach medicine today. Mm-hmm. So prevention, holistic, organic, mm-hmm. I'm there. It's all part of it. I think we have to it's like what I said about housing or education. The whole model is broken.
Broken, yeah.
The way we train doctors is broken. Mm-hmm. Not integrated, and it's not preventive, and it's not holistic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I had to kind of pry into you just a bit there for the audience's sake. Well, lastly, because we're running down on time, and I'll try to squeeze this in really quick, is there any topic that you want to cover that I didn't go over? Feel free to speak about it if you want.
I will. So after you and I hang up, and I'm going to give myself 15 minutes just to kind of go over what I've written, I'm going to release a statement. See, breaking news for you. You get the scoop.
All right. Okay. I like that.
Saying which presidential candidates I endorse in which states.
Okay.
And I'm doing that because I think it's critically important that, first of all, as you've said in doing this show, it's important that people understand all the options out there.
Yeah.
It's also important that we do not split the independent vote. Mm-hmm. I understand how hard it is to get on the ballot. We're on the ballot in Iowa and Arkansas. Mm-hmm. We're write-in candidates in about 12 other states.
Okay.
I am announcing who I'm supporting. I'm leaning heavily towards the Veterans Party of America.
Okay.
Well, you know, while conventional media has been focused on that two-party circus, independent candidates have been meeting in debates and discussion forums all year. I know of at least 10 different independent presidential debates. I've been in 8 different independent presidential debates. Mm-hmm. We are getting to know each other, the ones that are credible. And, you know, I mean, I have learned that people think if they have good opinions and can stand on stage and shout their opinion, then they're a presidential candidate. So it's more than opinions, you know. But if there are fantastic candidates out there, and the Veterans Party of America, Chris Kenniston, as a presidential nominee, is one of the best. So I'm going to start tonight, stand up and say, it's not just about voting for me, voting for me, voting for me. Mm-hmm. It's about understanding who are your choices.
Yes.
And picking independent candidates in each state that will also make it easier for them to be on the ballot next time. So do these small parties, and do I have to collect the same 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 signatures again the next go around? Or will there be slots for these independent parties to be able to field candidates? And that's why I'm announcing who I'm supporting for president in 23 states.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing more of you. Hopefully this is not the last time you stop by, and hopefully at that time my blog talk is straightened out and we can just go live and interact with the audience there.
That would be great. And I remember you asked questions I didn't answer, so I can start with those next time.
Okay, what questions were they? I had forgotten. I've just moved right on along.
Immigration, I think, is a big one. So my vice presidential running mate, Kathy Monahan, her areas of expertise are immigration, border control, homeland security, and homeland defense. So we actually have really thought this through. And some of my concerns with some parties is they're a little on the naive side. You can't just open up all the borders. There are people who want to hurt us. And that's the reality these days.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it at another time, later date.
Yes.
Thank you for coming through. I really, really enjoyed chatting with you today. And like I said, hopefully this is not the last time.
Absolutely. Happy to do it again. And thank you.
From so welcome.
The heart of independent candidates everywhere.
All right.
Canada. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm going to close out right here. I have about maybe 2 or 3 minutes left. All right. I can't say we're coming to the end of the broadcast. We are at the end of the broadcast. For those that didn't get a chance to chime in live, remember, I will be uploading this to all of my social media streams so you can tune in, whether that's the YouTube channel, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn itself, Spreaker, Parcoalition, radio.com, and even Blog Talk once that's completely cleared up. And also, you can also go to www.hmiradio.info to connect with me that way as well. So once again, I'm going to say thank you, Dr. Khan. I'm Anem A. Bay, and I look forward to the audience presence again here on HMI Radio. And as I always say, peace, namaste, and ashe. Thank you so much, and have a great evening.
You too.